Distributing the Future, broadcast September 19th, 2006, Metaphor.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week we look at two metaphors for open source. Scott Yara says that open source is like rock and roll, while Robert Lefkowitz says that open source is like a tomato. Did you get your five a day? Finally, we listen in on a new podcast that David Bettino has launched on digital audio. Okay, here's a game for you. Write down the name of common items or activities. A pizza, a snowman, bowling, a train, a fuse box, maybe a coffee maker. Jot down a whole bunch of them. Now, get a stack of index cards and put one on each card. And the next time you have a concept that's hard to describe, build a metaphor with one of these nouns or verbs that you've chosen. You might begin with something like, a good marriage is like a pizza, or life is like bowling, or entropy is like a snowman, or something else. It doesn't seem to initially make sense, maybe, but work with it. Probe deeper. Have fun with it. For the life of me, I don't understand free as in beer. I never remember what that's supposed to convey, but maybe that's because I never think of beer as being free. Then again, my understanding of free as in speech has certainly been challenged of late, too. We have two segments today that explore a metaphor for open source. The strength of a metaphor is in this exploration. Scott Yara begins with his thoughts on why open source is like rock and roll.
When you think about rock and roll, you know, it started just like open source did, simply because people just enjoyed doing it. They had really something to express to the world in the form of music, not code. And really, I think the thing that I love about rock music and open source is it's really traditionally been associated with threatening the establishment. But then the money jumped in. People saw that there was money to be made in rock music, and the anti-establishment of rock music quickly became the establishment and changed mainstream culture. And rock became a big business, and that really changed quite a few things. My big first thing is, you know, let's not box it in. I think we really need to expand our views on what we call open source. Let's not shrink it. The definition, I think, we're not going to find for open source is not really in the fine print of the GPL license or BSD or Apache today. Just as in rock and roll, you know, we really don't look to the Webster's Dictionary or even our beloved Wikipedia to really sort of tell us, you know, what Buddy Holly and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Led Zeppelin and the Ramones, you know, what all these guys have in common, what makes them similar. You know, ultimately, when you think about rock and roll, at its best, it's really an ideal. It's a shared spirit. It's something that's not written down. It's not well defined. It's something that represents a threat to the establishment. It's music that was made for expressing sort of real emotions. I think something that we've gone away from in proprietary software, where open source was so attractive to users and development communities, because it was about solving real problems and scratching itches. It was honest. You know, rock music is honest. I think that's when it's at its best. Open source represents sort of, you know, the sort of what brings out the best in honesty, and it's dangerous. You know, so I'll talk a little bit about that at the end. I think, you know, open source and rock music are best when they really threaten the establishment. They're a little bit dangerous. The other thing is think about is the economy. You know, rock music has a certain economy to it, where I think it's stripped down and it's to the point. You know, great sort of attributes of open source. And it sort of taught us that more complicated doesn't always necessarily mean better. So open source, you know, don't box it in. I think let it have many different models. Let many different models sort of have their shot. I think a great example of this is Adam Bosworth from Google, who had a really terrific blog post about a year and a half ago called Where All the Good Databases Gone. And in that post, he really sort of talked about how the proprietary commercial software world was really not meeting the needs of scale that Google and other online services were looking at in relational systems for today. And so he had a great message at the end of the post. His message was really to the open source community. It said, really kind of, please finish the job. Give to us in the database platform what we've seen with web servers in terms of scalability and robustness. You know, I think for him to associate open source with as something that could really sort of threaten the establishment and perhaps be the only way to get the big database problem done, I think is a very powerful currency. I think we need to think about that. It's not in the definition of the BSD license why he was turning to the open source model. And that's something that as a community, I think we can't afford to squander. So the biggest risk comes around to sort of the second aspect of what I wanted to talk about today. You know, I know it's a common trap that I, including myself, get excited when having people from all around the world download our software. That's a really exciting thing. But I think we have to sort of come to the point where, you know, just because software is downloaded, it doesn't really mean it's good. If that theory were true, the best operating system would certainly be Windows and the best browser would be IE. So what I want to do is sort of encourage all of us, when we join an open source company or project, to really start to think about whether or not your aspirations are more along the lines of Hendrix or Hansen. We need to keep open source real. I think that's what made it successful. Because in the end, I think we can end up hurting open source rather than helping it, which is, I think, what we all want to do. That's why we're all here today. And I think it's important. You know, people are really starting to believe that open source is better. It's a better development model. That it's a better path to getting things done. It's a very powerful currency. And again, we want to really use that to our advantage. And that brings us to the sort of final aspect of my talk today, which is, you know, let's absolutely find the dollars, but let's keep our integrity. I think there's a trend in open source. It's kind of things like, you know, sifting through SourceForge and trying to find an active open source project and then immediately start a company to sell support and services, an exact analog of the commercial company. And then the other aspect is you go and try to round up. I've seen a lot of business people go and try to round up a bunch of core team members purely for PR and selling value. My message today is, you know, I think we're actually better than that. That approach is really not going to give us the kind of multi-billion dollar market that I think the open source industry absolutely needs. It's important that for open source to win, we keep it real and we keep it dangerous. Dangerous like Darwin's theory of evolution, dangerous like Crick and Watson's discovery of DNA, dangerous like Cerf and Kahn's original design for TCP/IP and the internet. So my parting wish to all of you and for open source in general is that we keep it real and keep it dangerous.
Greenplum's Scott Yarra. Now, maybe a harder metaphor to make is that open source is like a tomato. If anyone is up to the task, however, it's Robert Lefkowitz. Not only does Rommel paint the metaphor for us, but he shows us the paths he rejected along the way and the implications of the one he chose. How did he get started down this path? Well, he explains.
When I loaded the template for a open source keynote, it started out with open source is like a tomato, was what came to mind. So the extended metaphor is open source is like a tomato. And where we could go is, I'm sure everybody's familiar with the story that in 1820 in the United States, Robert Gibbon Johnson stood on the courthouse steps in Salem, New Jersey, and bit into a tomato, which was a tremendously scandalous thing to do because everybody thought tomatoes were poisonous. Now, of course, the story isn't true. We could make the metaphor around, well, the tomato's like open source because in the beginning people thought it was dangerous and then they've accepted it and it become mainstream, but I'm not going to make that metaphor. And then once it became a mainstream kind of a food and people were no longer afraid that they were going to be poisoned by the tomato, people started eating lots of tomatoes and they began importing tomatoes, and the 1883 Tariff Act imposed a 10% import tax on vegetables. And an enterprising gentleman decided to import tomatoes and not pay the tax, and he argued that the tomato is not a vegetable, it is a fruit, because it has seeds, fruit of the vine. And this went to the Supreme Court, and a famous decision handed down in 1893 in Nix v. Hedden. The Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, although the tomato was botanically a fruit, like the squash and the cucumber, nevertheless, it was served after the soup and before the dessert, thus culinarily a vegetable, and therefore subject to the tax. So not only was it culinarily a vegetable, but it was legally a vegetable, even though botanically a fruit. And the minute I saw that, I said, aha! Now we could do some kind of an extended metaphor to talk about the semasiology, if you will, or the hermeneutics of open source as it relates to tomato. Is it a fruit or a vegetable? But I am not going to make that metaphor. And then in 1981, the Reagan administration decided to classify ketchup as a vegetable because it had tomatoes in it, which then suggests that one could draw an extended metaphor about, well, if you're using open source in your proprietary product, then you have these sort of mixed business models with open source, and it's kind of like making ketchup, but I'm not going to make that metaphor. But in 1994, the first genetically modified whole food was approved by the FDA in the United States. And of course, that first genetically modified whole food was a tomato made by Calgene Corporation. And of course, Calgene Corporation was immediately sued for patent infringement by a number of people, because of course they had patented a tomato as well. So this could be a jumping off point to say, aha, you see the correlations between open source patents and tomato patents and the dangers of the patent system and so forth, but I am not going to make that metaphor. The reason I'm not going to make that metaphor is because when I thought about it, I said this, you know, if they had, instead of calling it genetically engineered, genetically modified, or biofoods, they had called it food 2.0. It would have succeeded. So, but I do want to stop and point out that it was the flavor saver tomato. So among other things, they did invent the removal of the final vowel preceding an R. And not only that, they did it better than anybody else because they did it twice, and there is an inherent pun because the vowel that they removed from the first word was an O, and the vowel that they removed from the second word is either an E or an O. Get it? But then it turns out, of course, that the tomato, unbeknownst to many, is the number one vegetable or fruit, depending whether you're talking botanically culinary, in the United States. Right? So that even though it ranks 16th among all the fruits and vegetables as a source of vitamin A and vitamin C inherently, when adjusted for consumption, the tomato is the most important provider of vitamin A and vitamin C in the Western world. And that suggests that certainly in the world of vegetables, the tomato has achieved world domination. And that is where we might have a metaphor. So I started thinking, so what is it about fruits and vegetables that we know? And the one thing that we know is, over the years, people figured out that you ought to eat 5 fruits and vegetables a day. Well, that was the original target, and now the target has been increased even, that you should eat 5 to 9 fruits and vegetables a day, because it's much more subtle than that. Children should eat 5 fruits and vegetables a day, but women should eat 7, and men should eat 9, and of course, it depends on your lifestyle, and there's all this stuff. This stuff can be figured out. In fact, we have figured it out for fruits and vegetables. Of course, no size fits all, right? And you have to work out what is a portion. You're supposed to eat 5 portions of fruits and vegetables a day, and different foods have different fruits and different vegetables have different portion sizes and whatnot. But nevertheless, we have worked this all out so that you can then capture all this complexity and kind of a slogan which gives you a target. We should eat 5 fruits and vegetables a day. Of course, the average American eats 3 fruits and vegetables a day. And for 25-odd years, the government has been running public service campaigns, eat 5 a day. There are all these contests, colorful websites, children's games, eat 5 fruits and vegetables a day. And we still don't. So if you can quantify it, if you can come up with a number and say, this is where we want to be, and this is where we are, a simple number, and it hides a lot of complexity under the table. Nevertheless, it gives you some directionality, and you know how you're doing. Because one of the things that I've heard a couple of times in the last couple of days is, you know, open source has won. It's kind of mainstream now, so there's really nothing left to do. We should move on. And maybe we should. So here's the metaphor, because the Netcraft survey, of course, says Apache. So the Apache web server is the tomato, the most important fruit and vegetable. But in general, for fruits and vegetables, you have open source. So open source fruits and vegetables, we know it's good for you, as fruits and vegetables are good for you, so how many portions should you eat a day? Or some metaphor around, you know, how much open source is healthy. And I started thinking about this whole train of thought when I saw a survey on Ars Technica that, according to the collected data, approximately 87% of American organizations use open source software within them. And the first thing that popped into my head was, wow, you know, that's kind of like saying, approximately 87% of all Americans have eaten a vegetable. That's terrible. But the people who wrote the article thought, that's pretty good. So obviously, we're not measuring the same things, right? Substantial levels of deployment, significant levels of open source. Right? Well, is that good or bad? What's the number? What is our target? How much open source is healthy? Well, now, some people say it should all be open source. And these, of course, are the vegetarians. Wow, or vegans, I suppose. I mean, it's absolutely. And when you start doing that, people think, oh, you're being a little extreme. I mean, you know, what's wrong with a little meat or chicken now and then? You know, fish is good for you, too. And so, yes, so you don't want to be looking extreme, right? Plus, there are many different reasons that you might want to be a vegan. I mean, that's, you know, many people are vegetarians because they love animals, right? But I know people who are vegetarians because they hate plants. Fanaticism is, you know, not good on either side. So how much is healthy? Okay, now if you do more than two-thirds of your software to be open source, that's too much, right? Then you're looking like you're a zealot, right? But then you start thinking, well, but less than one-third, well, then it starts sort of dwindling in significance. How are you going to walk into the CIO and say, you know, we don't use enough open source. 10% of our software ought to be open source, right? 90% of our software, of course, then by presumably ought not to be. It starts dropping off the executive agenda. Right? So clearly, the correct number is somewhere in between. It's got to be at least a third. So you say, well, this is kind of important, but you don't want to be more than two-thirds because then you're being too zealous. So I want to put a stake in the ground. I want to be a reasonable, rational American businessman and say one-third of all software use ought to be open source. See, that's a good target to shoot for. Which says, because then you can pitch it both ways. That sounds pretty aggressive. You could also say, well, you should be using twice as much proprietary software as open source software. You know, but that's still good. That's the right balance. Because many people make the statement, you know, it ought to be a balance. And Neil Dash made that. You know, you got to mix and match, and it's not all proprietary. But nobody wants to commit to a number. So here's the number. 33%. 33% of what? Okay, now so how are we going to measure this? Are you eating your portions? And you can measure it by lines of code that are being executed, but then that's kind of hard. You don't know, really. Number of projects. Tim has an observation that it really is not about the code that you're running on your machine anyway. The stuff could be running in the cloud someplace in the network, and how can you tell whether it's open source or not? So it becomes a complicated thing to measure, very much like, well, you know, how much is a portion of broccoli versus how much is a portion of tomato? But, you know, these things are, we should figure this thing out. And I think there really has only ever been one measure of use. All business models eventually boil down to the same thing, which is how many people are using this stuff. It's the number of users. Right? So we have to measure how many people are using open source software. And the minute you start measuring how many people are using open source software, the transitivity problem arises. Is open source transitive? That means if you're using open source for your product and then I use your product, am I using open source? And this question, of course, arises for anybody who's a Windows user. First thing I did when I got my copy of Windows XP was I read release note KB306819, which is the copyright notice. And if you read down far enough, you get to a bunch of stuff where something like, because Microsoft has included the Regents of the University of California, Berkeley software in this product, Microsoft is required to include the following text that accompanied such software. And you say, whoa, this is open source. I recognize it. You read further down, and in fact, that sentence keeps repeating over and over again. Hewlett-Packard Software, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, University of Michigan. My God, who knew? Windows XP is open source. So I'm using it, so I'm open source. Everybody's using it. Everybody's open source. We're right. We have one. Unless it's not transitive. Just a quick show of hands, how many people think open source is transitive? How many people think open source is not transitive? How many people want me to explain what transitive means again? So thinking about this from inside of a large corporation, come across the question that says, okay, so we agree that if you're using Windows or Internet Explorer, just because Microsoft embedded some BSD software in there, that doesn't mean that you've successfully converted to open source because you've successfully installed Windows XP. What happens if you're in an organization, you're using Sugar CRM, or you're using JBoss, right, and you're writing all of this stuff, and you're deploying it to your call centers, or your sales clerks, or your hotel reservation clerks, and they're using this GPL derivative software that you've got in-house. Are they using open source software? Well, if it's not transitive, then they're not. People in IT maybe are using open source software and producing some product, which they're then distributing internally to these people who are not using open source software because they don't have any of the rights, none of the GPL stuff triggers, and they don't have any of those freedoms that we just hear about talking with open source software. And then if you stop thinking about it that way, you say, only maybe 1% of people are using open source software today. So we're not as far as we need to be to get up to a third. And you can measure it financially, too. Right? If you take a look at how much the Fortune 500 spend on IT, and you look at how much all of the open source companies are making, then it's like 2% of that. So we're nowhere near a third. I think we should get to a third. I think that should be our slogan. Let's use twice as much proprietary software as open source software. That's the target. Thank you very much.
Robert Lefkowitz. David Bettino has launched a new podcast called The O'Reilly Digital Media Insider. You can listen to the audio process come alive as he plays the clips behind some of the articles on the digital media site. In the first episode, David shows how songwriter and Pro Tools guru Gina Fatt-Saez applies transforms by chaining event plugins.
This is a little 30-second piece that I threw together for this article, Plugins for Musicians and Songwriters. It's using completely all plugins. It started with this loop that you're hearing right now, which is a loop that's coming from Ultimate Sound Bank's virtual instrument Extreme Effects. And Extreme Effects, it's got Foley sounds, it's got all sorts of sound effects, really great transitional sounds, and it's also got some very musical but very, very unique sounds. It's really, really great for sound design and really great for film scoring and stuff like that, but I love to throw little elements in like this really kind of cool loop. So after I got the loop going, I decided to open up Stylus RMX and play with some grooves along with this funky little loop. And so I added this, and then I added this, and then I added a bass line, and then I added Atmosphere, a synth part. And then for the melody, I started with another Ultimate Sound Bank virtual instrument called Charlie, which is all organ sounds, really, really great, cool, thick organ sounds. So I started with Charlie and I played this part. And then I added another Extreme Effects sound. Then I decided to layer with piano. And I'm using Synthegy's Ivory for the piano, and I also have Soundtoy's Echo Boy on the piano track. So the only other thing I added was a backward cymbal into the downbeat of the entire piece and a crash cymbal on the downbeat using Stylus RMX.
Thanks to Scott Yara, Robert Lefkowitz, David Bettino, and Gina Fatt-Saez. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks also to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This audio was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.